Good morning. This morning's reading comes from John chapter 12, verses 1 to 24. I'll be reading from the NIV translation. It's John chapter 12, verses 1 to 24. 6 days before the Passover, Jesus came to Bethany, where Lazarus lived, whom Jesus had raised from the dead. Here a dinner was given in Jesus' honor. Martha served, while Lazarus was among those reclining at the table with him. Then Mary took a pint of pure nard, an expensive perfume. She poured it on Jesus' feet and wiped his feet with her hair. And the house was filled with the fragrance of the perfume. But one of his disciples, Judas Iscariot, who was later to betray him, objected, "Why wasn't this perfume sold and the money given to the poor? It was worth a year's wages." He did not say this because he cared about the poor, but because he was a thief. As keeper of the money bag, he used to help himself to what was put into it. "Leave her alone," Jesus replied. "It was intended that she should save this perfume for the day of my burial. You will always have the poor among you, but you will not always have me." Meanwhile, a large crowd of Jews found out that Jesus was there and came, not only because of him, but also to see Lazarus, whom he had raised from the dead. So the chief priests made plans to kill Lazarus as well, for on account of him, many of the Jews were going over to Jesus and believing in him. The next day, the great crowd that had come for the festival heard that Jesus was on his way to Jerusalem. They took palm branches and went out to meet him, shouting, "Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. Blessed is the King of Israel." Jesus found a young donkey and sat on it. As it is written, "Do not be afraid, daughter Zion. See, your king is coming, seated on a donkey's colt." At first, his disciples did not understand all this. Only after Jesus was glorified did they realize that these things had been written about him, and that these things had been done to him. May the crowd that was with him when he called Lazarus from the tomb and raised him from the dead continue to spread the word. Many people, because they had heard that he had performed this sign, went out to meet him. So the Pharisees said to one another, "See, this is getting us nowhere. Look how the whole world has gone after him." Now there were some Greeks among those who went up to worship at the festival. They came to Philip, who was from Bethsaida in Galilee, with a request. "Sir," they said, "we would like to see Jesus." Philip went to tell Andrew. Andrew and Philip, in turn, told Jesus. Jesus replied, "The hour has come for the Son of Man to be glorified. Very truly I tell you, unless a kernel of a wheat falls to the ground and dies, it remains only a seed. But if it dies, it produces many seeds." This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God.
Thank you, David, for reading for us. So it's Palm Sunday again, as we've said, and I have had the opportunity, the pleasure to preach on Palm Sunday many times over the years. And some of them have been in children's all-age services as well, where we've been able to do celebrations coming into the church and waving palm branches. And some of them have been straightforward preaches on the topic. I've done things like who Jesus was, what he intended to do, and how he was going to do it. Things like he raised his profile, he responded to prophecy, and he required a position. Different homiletics like that, and different sermons and so on this very familiar story to many of us. Now I know not everyone will have heard the story before; it'll be new perhaps. But many of us as Christians have heard this story quite a lot. So when it comes to preparing a message on it for this morning, I'm kind of left thinking, what can I bring that people haven't heard before? You've heard about the fact that Jesus was fulfilling lots of prophecy in what he was doing. We've heard about the different things to do with the crowd's praise and so on, and the fact that not everyone understood necessarily what was going on and why Jesus had come. So what is there new to bring? Well, what I decided to do this morning is a bit different than a straightforward sermon or preach. I'm going to just offer some reflections on the passage that we've just read. The reason we included Jesus anointed at Bethany by Mary is because that also comes in John's Gospel. In John chapter 12, and you know we've been following a series in John's Gospel, up to chapter 12, which we're actually going to finish today because now we're jumping into the Easter Sunday next week. So this will be the last one in this present series. But both these stories come here together. John's placed that story next to the one with the Palm Sunday parade. And both of them, in some way, are expressing praise and celebration of Jesus. So it ties nicely together, and I want to reflect on them both this morning. The thing I want to do is look more at Jesus, his character, the way he always provoked a response from people, whether that was people warming to him and wanting to celebrate him, or whether it was people turning against him. And we see lots of emotion in these two stories, as we do in the whole story of the passion of Jesus, which is in the latter half, the second half of the Gospels. It's all to do with the passion, it's called, as this week in Jesus's life unfolds. And people's emotions and tensions are high and so on like that as he goes through this week. But people tended to always react to Jesus in a particular, either a strong way against or a strong way for. We start with Mary's reaction, her response, and it was extravagant devotion. The nard oil perfume came from India. We talked with Jerin and Hannah this morning from India. It was a plant, and it was from the roots of the plant, this oil type perfume. It was very expensive, exported in. And of course, Mary breaks it open and pours it out over Jesus to anoint him. And the scene of her wiping his feet with her hair, imagine that perfume. It said the smell filled the house and so on. Imagine what her hair smelled like after that, ladies, after using that to wipe his feet with. It was a really extravagant act. And the first question, and this today is just going to be some reflections on this passage. The first question is this: how can we emulate Mary's devotion? How can we translate that to today and emulate that devotion and expression of love to Jesus? Surely there's no gift or sacrifice that's too great to show our gratitude for what Jesus did on the cross for us. So is our expression of gratitude extravagant? Is our expression of praise extravagant? How can we show that and emulate that? Is it with praise, with singing? Is it with money, gifts, time? These are things perhaps in your home groups this week. Some of the things I'll talk about are questions that you could think about and reflect on there a bit more. Let's move on. Verse 13 talks about the crowd's extravagant praise. Which was quite risky. So they're all coming out and they're praising with palm branches and so on. That's extravagant praise as well, as they all come out. It was extravagant in being risky as well, because, of course, the chief priests and the Pharisees didn't like what Jesus was doing. And so they were people were getting thrown out of the temple because of following Jesus. So to actually come out and be so bold as to praise him in that way was quite risky. And what about the Romans? They were shouting he was king, blessed is the king of Israel, which wasn't acknowledging the king of Rome in the same way. So it was quite risky. Should we be more loud and bold in our witness and praise of Jesus than we are sometimes? Are we risky and extravagant in that way as well? And then this whole story starts with a dinner that was given in Jesus's honor. The whole dinner, the whole meal, it says, was given in Jesus' honor. And I guess it was a kind of celebration and a witness in a way to what he'd done. People would be invited to come and meet with Lazarus as well. Jesus had healed Lazarus and brought him back from the dead, rather. And so people were all talking about that. It was the big news around. And it was a celebration of what Jesus had done, but also a celebration of who he was as well, and a witness to other people. I wonder, could we do a dinner in Jesus's honor? How would that work? Is this an evangelistic possible thing we could do as a church? That we take over a hotel or a restaurant in the town and we say we're holding a dinner in Jesus's honor and we invite people to it. We invite people randomly in the town who we go up to and invite them to come along to a meal in Jesus's honor and give them a free ticket to a meal, fund it as a church and give towards it. I hope the treasurer's not here this morning listening to this. But anyway, and invite them along and have a meal together. Christians around the room, chatting with other people, talking about we're doing this in Jesus's honor because of how great we believe he is. I mean, who isn't up for a free meal? I'm sure people would come. And then we could tell this story. We could even open a jar of perfume in the restaurant, if they let us, and let the smell go through the restaurant or the hotel. Who knows? Maybe it's something we could do in our own homes even. That would be extravagant, wouldn't it? But could be extravagant celebration of who Jesus is and an extravagant way of witnessing for him as well. As we reflect on these things, let's move on. Because it wasn't all positive response to Jesus, was it? There was a negative response as well. As soon as this woman did this, Judas immediately has a negative response. He criticizes the act. He says it's a year's wages, basically, of perfume just going. This money could have been better given to the poor. Surely Jesus wouldn't like this. He'd be more concerned about the poor than what was happening here. Honestly, if we're honest, might we have criticized too? It's easy to look at Judas on hindsight and say, oh, critical spirit, and he was wrong. It's because he had, but might we have criticized that too? Do we sometimes criticize acts of extreme devotion today too? And kind of like, oh, you're just holier than thou attitude, or you're one of those Christians who's a bit, a bit carried away with it all. What about such extravagant acts today in different ways? What about those people who decide to build extravagant churches, cathedrals? Is that an act of devotion that people just want to express the praise and the thanks of God? And so they build a temple that's worthy of him, if you like. They build a cathedral that's worthy of him. They build a church that's a great building. They decorate it well, put best into it, like you would be proud and look after your own home perhaps, but you want to make God's house even better. Is that an act of devotion in this same way? Or would that money be better spent on the poor? Can you imagine the arguments in churches over the years of those that criticised that decision to spend money in that way and say it could be better on the poor, and those who said, no, this is our way of showing our love of God? I bet it's caused many divisions over the years. And Jesus says, you'll always have the poor among you to look after, to give to care for. Jesus isn't physically here now with us, but the poor still are, aren't they? They are still here. And so there's a challenge here as well in acting upon this in terms of how we can care for the poor today. Whether or not we build the buildings, whether or not we try and express our devotion in other ways in that way, but giving to the poor who are amongst us now, by Jesus saying this, he wasn't saying it isn't important to do that. He was just saying that was important at that time. And we know this. So what are we doing now to be extravagant in our care of the poor today? Ade, Bashad, our church senior trustee, did a talk on this the other day. He looked at poverty on a Sunday evening and talked about the issues around poverty. And it was really good on our Sunday evening service. Raised some of these issues about a challenge of responding to the poor and the needy in our society. Maybe this is something else in our home groups as well we can talk about, is how can we take this challenge and do so effectively as individuals and as a church. It's interesting in verse 6 here as well. This is just almost an aside. But Judas didn't have this criticism because he cared about the poor. He had this criticism because it says he liked to take a bit off the side in the money bag, didn't he? He was a thief and he looked after the money bag. I wonder why Jesus didn't stop him. Why Jesus would put him in charge of the money bag? Surely Jesus knew this about him. Why did he let him have the money bag? People were probably giving sacrificially to Jesus's mission to care for the disciples, and yet Jesus entrusts him with the money bag, knowing, no doubt, that he was taking off the side. How would you feel if you were giving to the church and you knew that someone was taking off the side and stealing money from it? You'd be outraged. You'd want them to be sacked. Jesus knew, but he let this guy carry on. Was this a unique situation because he was the betrayer? Or is there even something we can learn from this? Is this something to do with where people maybe are doing things, but we allow it for now, but it will come to its point? It's interesting to think about. Jesus told a parable, didn't he, of the wheat and the weeds growing together, and then the harvest and the judgment would come. I'll let you ponder on that one, and it can, again, be something for small groups, home groups and things to think about as well. And I'll write some of these questions down for you for your groups during the week if you want to reflect on any of these things more. Let's move on again. Verse 7 says it was intended that this should happen, that this perfume should be saved for the burial, Jesus says. These events were all carefully prepared, from the perfume to the parade and the prophecies that foretold of these things. It was all carefully planned and prepared. Jesus getting the donkey, we read in the other Gospels how he arranged for the donkey to come and so on as well, and be there for him. He planned it all. He was prepared and ready. But were the people ready for him coming? Not really. They had false expectations, didn't they? They thought that he was coming to be a different kind of king, the king that they wanted him to be, who was going to overthrow the Romans, who was going to be the new king that was going to give them victory over everybody and stop them being oppressed by the Romans. And Jesus hadn't come that way. He'd come as a servant king. He was the Messiah and the king, but they misunderstood what he was about. In verse 37 of this passage, we didn't read that one, but in verse 37 it says, even after Jesus had performed so many signs in their presence, they still would not believe him. They're praising him 1 minute, and less than a week later, they are crying, crucify him, many of these people, because he didn't do what they expected or wanted him to do. It raises a few questions for us. First of all, they weren't ready for Jesus. Are we ready for Jesus? Because Jesus will come again, just like he came that day. He will come again. And are we ready and prepared to receive him? If Jesus came back in 7 days' time, let's say on Easter Sunday, would you do anything different this week? It's a sobering thought. Would we do anything different to prepare ourselves for Jesus coming if we knew this was it and we were going to meet him face to face? It also raises the thing that the crowd had been longing for the Messiah to come all this time, to make things right, to save them and so on from the Romans. I wonder what you've been longing for Jesus to do for you. Is there anything that you're longing for Jesus to do for you in your life? In your family? in church, in the town, a situation may be. Well, Jesus came, and while many were really glad, some were disappointed because he didn't fulfill their expectations and they turn against him. Is there a temptation when Jesus doesn't fulfill our expectations, when the things don't go the way that we're hoping, what we're longing for Jesus to do, for people to show less devotion to Jesus, less commitment, to even turn away from him because he doesn't fulfill what they want, what we want? I think that happens sometimes, doesn't it? We get a little bit more relaxed about things and sin becomes easier and doing things, not being as devoted or committed to him. Is this something we can try and guard against? Because he is still the Messiah, he is still the King, and he knows what he's doing. At first, it says in verse 16, at first the disciples didn't understand all of this. They didn't understand everything that was happening. We don't understand everything. We don't understand why COVID's here at the moment. If people are trying to find a reason for it, aren't they? Some people are saying it's God's judgment. Some people are saying, God doesn't like it, but he isn't getting rid of it at the moment because he has a plan or something. You know, people have all different ideas about this. It's one of those things of living in a fallen world, I think. But whether there's a reason, whatever's behind or not, and why God doesn't stop all the death or whatever else, we don't necessarily understand. And it's the same with other things in our life. We won't always understand, will we, why God is doing what he's doing or not doing what we think he should be doing. But looking back, often we can see. Are there things that you've been able to see in your life as you look back and think, yeah, I see what God was doing there? But it's only in hindsight, it's only later on as we reflect and we look back and we see how God has led and journeyed with us. And sometimes we may not know, but one day we will. When we get to heaven, we'll know, we'll understand, because God's way is best and he knows what he's doing. We need to trust him. And the last bit I just want to look at is just a couple of other reflections before I finish. First of all, you know, by this point, Lazarus had almost become as big a star as Jesus. I mean, it says that people were coming to Jesus because of him as well, and people wanted to see Lazarus as well. He was like The Walking Dead, like the movie The Walking Dead. He was like The Walking Dead. He'd risen from the dead. People wanted to see him. And Lazarus was really popular at the time. And so it says that the chief priests made plans. It says in verse 10 there. So the chief priests made plans to kill Lazarus as well, for on account of him, many of the Jews were going over to Jesus and believing in him. So they wanted to kill Lazarus as much as Jesus, really. Did they succeed? Did they succeed in killing Lazarus? Do you know what? It doesn't say. We don't know. If not, why not? If they could kill Jesus, and it was more difficult to kill Jesus, presumably, if they could kill Jesus, why couldn't they kill Lazarus if they wanted to? Would Jesus allow it? Just after he'd raised him from the dead and all the distress it had caused Mary and Martha and everyone before, would he allow him just to be killed again the next week or something? You know? We don't know whether he died or not. We often don't know what's happening and what God's doing. But I find that interesting that they were after him just as much as Jesus at this time. And he hadn't done anything wrong. He'd just come back from the dead because Jesus brought him back from the dead. Well, Jesus rode the donkey in. And as he did so, he makes this statement of intent. He was here as the servant Messiah King. And I want to ask you this as well. If you were to write a statement of intent as a Christian, what would it be? What would your statement of intent be? Jesus says, I'm here. I'm not the Messiah coming on a stallion, like Aaron said at the beginning, or in a Porsche. I'm here riding on a donkey. I'm a servant king. I'm coming to do something. I'm going to die for you, basically, was what he was telling them as a servant king. That was his statement of intent, was getting on that donkey and coming in that way. And all of the prophecy fulfilled in that. What's our statement of intent as a Christian? What should we be about? What could we say our life is about and our church should be about? 2 years ago, I preached on Palm Sunday and I said what I thought our statement of intent as Christians should be. I summarized in as short a way as possible what our mission should be as Christians, as individual Christians, and as a church. And I'm going to remind you what that was. And I want to reflect on it after Easter in the coming weeks. I said our mission should be, our statement of intent should be these things: to love God, to love others, and to make disciples. And you know the reason I say those things is this: because to love God and to love others are the greatest commandments, Jesus says. They sum up everything else. To love God with all our heart and to love others as ourselves. Is that not what all Jesus' teaching is about? Does it not fulfill everything that the commandments are about? And that's why Jesus highlighted them as the greatest commandments. If you do these things, you'll not be going far wrong, Jesus said. And then what about the other one? To make disciples. Well, that's the Great Commission. It's the commission that Jesus left us with, to go and share this good news with everyone else. Love God, love others, make disciples. That should be our statement of intent as Christian believers, as a church. And that's really what I want us to focus on and head into as we come out of Easter time. Do you know, I finish with this. In verse 19, it says the whole world had gone after him, that they observed. And then in verse 20, there were some Greeks who came. And that was just highlighting really in verse 20 what was said in verse 19, that these Greeks were coming now, that people who were Gentiles were coming as well. People outside of Jerusalem were coming and wanting to see what was going on. And they inquired about Jesus. We'd like to see Jesus, they said. The world was ready. And then in verse 23, just as after this, as part of this story, Jesus says, the hour has come. Because the world was ready to hear the good news. The Greeks were now inquiring, people from outside of Jerusalem, the world was ready to hear. Do you think there's people in our city who'd like to see Jesus? Do you think there are? People who'd like to see Jesus? What I mean is, like to meet Jesus. I'm sure they'd like to see him physically, but to meet him, to understand him. Do you think there are people who might? It's our job to make him known to them. How can we show them Jesus? That's perhaps the biggest challenge we have as a church in this town, in this city, and something we'll focus on after Easter as well. Let's just pray, shall we, together? Father God, thank you for this story. Recorded for us in scripture about all this passion and praise at Easter time here on Palm Sunday. Lord, as we reflect on it, may we never get bored of it. May we never become complacent with it. May we always see something new in it and be challenged afresh by it to live lives that honor you in every way. Help us to be bold witnesses of you, Jesus, to the world that needs to see you so much. And may we love you, God. May we love others. And may we be effective in making disciples. We ask it in your name, Jesus. Amen.